Welcome to episode 244 of the 6G podcast. It's the latest inside scoop on everything 6G. We cover about six topics in about 30 minutes, and it's brought to you by More Insights and Strategy. I'm Anshul Sog, and joining me again this week is fellow analyst Mike Dano from Ookla. And I just got back from GTC 2026 in San Jose, which was quite the whirlwind. Mike, were you anywhere this week or did you get a break from travel?
No, I got a break. I was here all the whole time, but I was actually watching all the NVIDIA stuff with great interest and had several conversations about it. Because I think all eyes are on GTC this week. That is ground zero for all the interesting stuff. Yeah, tell me what you saw. I'm actually quite curious to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, so I think in terms of telecom stuff, I think the biggest announcement that wasn't already announced at MWC was the grid AI or AI grid announcement, or however you want to call it. This is not to be confused with NVIDIA's already existing grid technology product, which is specifically for streaming games. They moved away from the grid name and turned it into GeForce Now, which is a cloud gaming streaming service. And they've repurposed grid for telecom uses. And this is a kind of like a mesh computing distributed network of compute, of course, utilizing NVIDIA GPUs and for AI acceleration. This is not to be confused with what they're doing in their AI RAM, because the partners that they're working with are actually, some of them don't even have a RAM like Comcast and Spectrum, but they are also partnering with AT&T Mobile. And they're also, Cisco's involved in this as well, as a networking partner, and they're part of the AT&T AI grid application. The AT&T application seems to be more IoT focused, while Comcast's is a little bit more generalized and actually mentions GeForce Now, which is funny because they do some GeForce Now optimizations with L4S, which is a whole other thing. It's a codec / thing that like allows the endpoint to communicate backward to the cloud and anticipate lag and reorganize packets. But not to get distracted, companies like Akamai are also involved. So it's a really big announcement. I think the one thing that's really interesting is that it feels like it's very broad in the sense that it's not just one way of doing things. And it's almost nebulous in a way, because I think it allows people to add more compute at different layers of the network. AI RAN is a very specific area of the network. This feels like it's a layer above that, somewhere either in the core network or somewhere in the cloud edge, all the way up in the cloud. It feels like it's more flexible. And what I think is interesting is a lot of the announcements that were talked about in this, or the types of products that were utilized in these announcements, were the NVIDIA RTX Pro 6000 cards, which are not really like edge AI. They're more like multi-purpose compute, which is there's a graphics capability to them as well. So it's not just for AI. It could also be for graphics. And I think that would be really interesting for stuff like for AR and VR at the edge, because then you could supplement that compute with those graphics cards that are maybe not at the RAM level right at the very edge, but they're just a little further back, which gives you a little bit more power, right? Because you're not going to run these 300 to 600 watt GPUs on the RAN like you would a much smaller one. So I think this is an interesting announcement because it creates a new layer, I think, of the network where compute can exist. But there's still a lot of AI RAN, I think, that kind of bolts onto this. And what's interesting is I didn't really get the sense that there was much talk of 6G in the talk about this grid, and that it was more about AI and enabling AI compute in different parts of the network. And yeah. I rambled quite a bit, so I'm going to let you respond.
No, I'm very interested to hear that. I was watching it from afar. That is what I got. It really does sound to me like NVIDIA is using AI to resurrect edge computing, because I feel like a lot of this kind of stuff has already been covered in the years before AI, sort of circa 2019, by companies like Ericsson had Edge Gravity. There was Mobile Edge X that was eventually acquired by Google. There's a lot of startups like Edge Micro and Vapor.io. And then companies like AT&T made deals with Microsoft for edge computing, and Verizon had a huge deal with AWS for edge computing. And even on the Verizon coverage map, you could see the edge, the MEX, the mobile edge compute locations that Verizon had started up. And I heard you talk about edge computing fabrics and these sort of federations of edge computing. And boy, this sounds very similar to that. Very similar. It's just you throw the AI on top.
What's really funny is I think you're right. In fact, somebody mentioned the word mech and then pulled it back very quickly when they said that. So I think you're right there.
Yeah.
But I think what's interesting is mech's biggest problem was it didn't have a killer app, right? It didn't have this, why do we need all this compute? Now, if you add AI to that, I think if AI had grown at the time when we had mech, I think it would have been fine. I think mech would have survived. So I do think having an application for this compute does help. And I think having other applications for this compute will also help, which is why I think it's really interesting that they're using the RTX Pro 6000 Blackwells, because they're multi-purpose, right? You can use them for graphics and you can use them for AI. So you could do that. You could accelerate some video workloads if you wanted to, because this GPU is that capable. It is expensive. It is power hungry, but it gives you flexibility and it doesn't have to only be AI applications, even though that's probably what's going to pay for 90% of these deployments.
I feel like in this age of AI, all previous assumptions are being thrown out the window. You just cannot anticipate what this AI wave is going to do. And so my natural setting is skeptical, especially because I feel like we just went through the edge computing thing and it just recently fell apart. But here we are in the age of AI and no former calculations can be applied to this new AI world, I think.
Fair.
I was going to say that brings me to the thing I wanted to talk about, which was the Bell announcement. This is exactly, and part of the reason that I am a little less skeptical this time around is because of announcements like we saw at Mobile World Congress from Deutsche Telekom and this new announcement from Bell. Basically, the announcement is that Bell is going to build a really big AI factory in Saskatchewan. And the thing that caught my eye was that Bell is going to invest, they said, $1.7 billion into building this thing. 80 jobs, lots of money. They're going to do the compute hardware, will be funded by Cerebras and CoreWeave. And most importantly, Bell is really putting some real money into this data center that they're building, to the degree where they're going to take a real big hit on their free cash flow this year, but they're estimating in 2028, adjusted EBITDA is going to grow much higher than what they previously expected. So after they pay for the build out, they're expecting a rise in their free cash flow due to this gigantic data center that they're building in Saskatchewan. And it really does tie directly into this idea of distributed compute. And for Bell specifically, it really ties into the idea of data sovereignty. That is their whole argument. This is a data center that is run for Canada by Canadians, owned by Canadian companies, with the data residing inside of the borders of Canada. And Bell has been very vocal about this AI strategy that they're embarking on. But I think the important thing with this announcement is that they're really putting some serious money behind it. And they talked about the amount of NVIDIA GPUs that this computing site is going to have. It really lines up with this whole thing. And the idea of follow the money, people at Bell have been convinced they're not just joining a federation of edge computing sites. They're not just spinning up one or two test sites. No, they're building a gigantic AI data center there in Saskatchewan, $1.7 billion. It is not insignificant. For Bell, that is serious capital outlay. And so they believe in this whole thing. I think that further erodes my skepticism of this trend. I think that there's really something here. I'm not entirely sure it makes the same amount of sense for an AT&T to build a data center in Virginia, but certainly for Bell in Canada, in the remote areas of Canada, I think that this kind of thing could, certainly Bell believes it's going to be successful.
Yeah, I saw this announcement and I thought it was a pretty big deal. What was really interesting is I had a conversation with the other Canadian carrier about something very similar and their investment in AI with TELUS. And they also had a very built in Canada, financed by Canada, for Canadians, sovereign AI. I think we're in a place where there's a very heavy focus on sovereign AI and empowering that. And it's, I don't think it's going to only happen in Canada, but I do think the relationship between the US and Canada has forced a little bit more of the Canadian carriers to take on the role of what maybe we would have expected a US CSP to do instead. And I think they want to protect their data. And I saw this is a 300 megawatt data center, so that's pretty considerable. It's not quite gigawatt scale like the US, but to your point, there's a reason why you probably won't see carriers deploy these kinds of things in the US, because most likely it's the CSPs with their gigawatt capacity that they're going to be deploying, not to mention the power infrastructure required to deliver that. I did see that it's happening in Saskatchewan, just right outside of Regina, which I made sure not to mispronounce because I've been corrected many times. Uh-huh. And yeah, the Canadian operators have also been notorious for underinvesting. So I think seeing them make this kind of commitment means that they're very serious, to your point, and they wouldn't make this decision lightly. And I think that there are probably some signals from the Canadian government that they're going to be more restrictive on AI and how, where AI data moves and how it's processed.
Yeah, I think that the idea of data sovereignty is just, it makes so much sense in the current geopolitical environment. I think that is absolutely the place where we'll see a lot of this kind of investment. Though, again, to offer a skeptical view, I think we still have not yet seen the killer AI app. There's not necessarily an AI service, I think a widespread AI service. It's certainly valuable. I use it all the time. I know a lot of people do. But I'm not yet convinced that there's enough demand for AI services to warrant this much investment in data centers to keep them running 24/7, to keep that demand up. I think we're all assuming that the AI marketplace is still in its infancy and that additional applications and usage will evolve over time. And I would not be surprised to see that. I guess we haven't seen it yet. I think that we are all expecting more out of this AI wave. It's just hard to tell exactly what it's going to result in, where we're going to be in a year or two in terms of AI technology and what we'll be doing with it.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think we might be getting a bit of a sense of that with some of these agentic Claw-based applications. And the application is actually the ability to work for you and do things for you while you do other things. But that's still very niche right now. And I think the productivity angle for companies is, it's almost invaluable, and being able to multiply people's productivity. So I think that seems to be where a lot of energy is being focused right now. But obviously that's not really the focus of, I think, like what these carriers are trying to do. I think what these carriers are trying to do might be a little bit more focused on private personal data, like medical and other sensitive AI data. Moving on to my second topic, I wanted to talk about foldables, specifically the Oppo Find N6, which is the latest foldable from Oppo. It is their first foldable with no crease, and they actually showed it on stage against the Fold 7 and how different they look with and without the crease. I think this will be a precursor for Apple's foldable, which will most likely also not have a crease, because that's one of the biggest critiques of these foldables, is the crease down the middle. In addition, it's also super thin. It's top of the line, 200 megapixel main camera, Snapdragon 8 Elite Gen 5, 6,000 milliamp hour battery. It's not quite as thin, I believe, as the Honor phone, or as big of a battery, but it's close. But I think it will have a better camera. And some reviews came out a few days ago and they're pretty glowing. But what's interesting is almost the same, at the same time as this new foldable came out, Samsung discontinued their Galaxy Z Trifold, which is a very high-end trifold phone, which is about $3,000. And yeah, it wasn't for a lack of demand, because they were selling out of basically everyone that they were making. I think they were just losing too much money on actually producing them. I think this was more of an exercise in showing that they could do it rather than actually trying to capture market share with it. Huawei, I assume, is also not making much money, if any, on their trifold. But again, Huawei is not really in the business of making money for their halos. So I think right now it looks like trifolds are like a concept that you might be able to buy, but isn't really economically viable because of all of the cost of the engineering. So I think we might not see trifolds be very common or very affordable. And I think that we'll probably see more of them, but in very low volumes. I think right now people seem to be focusing on just one fold. And I was a big fan of Oppo's foldables for a long time. They own OnePlus, and they did the Find N2, which was really a great phone and the basis of the OnePlus Open, but they haven't refreshed that one, so we're not going to get it in the US. And unfortunately, we're not going to get any of the Oppo phones in the US. But the cool thing is that the new Find N6 also has 80-watt charging and 50-watt wireless charging, so it's fast. And yeah, like, this isn't quite 6G, but I think foldables will become way more commonplace when 6G rolls around. And yeah, I think we're in a place where foldables are becoming like the top end rung of the market. And I think the biggest complaint that I've had in the past was cameras. And it seems like we're finally getting where the point where like foldable cameras are good enough that you don't need to carry around a second phone like I do, where I had the Fold 7, but I also had my iPhone because the camera was just so much better on the iPhone. But now I moved to an S26 Ultra and I'm reviewing that. And I love the camera, but it's not a foldable. Like, I'm already missing my foldable.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is that a form factor that you do? Are you a fan of foldables?
My biggest use case for a foldable, other than having my child's monitor, their crib monitor on one screen and doing stuff on another, I love having my work calendar and then my Gmail on the other screen and being able to just, oh, like someone's asking me, like, are you available this time? And just have the calendar open at the same time and not have to do the tab thing where you like do the windows and go back and forth. It's so much more valuable. Or best one, another one is have a menu open on one screen and then have the online ordering open on the other. There's so many applications where having two things open at the same time is great. And like over time, the phone also learns what those pairs might be and suggests pairings that you use together often. So yeah, like I'm a foldable convert. I'm not as converted on flips as I am on folds. I think folds are way more productivity focused, but the camera has always been a weakness. And I do think the Razr Ultra, which we talked about a few weeks ago, I think that will also solve a lot of problems in terms of the camera capabilities, and it might convince me to ditch the 26 Ultra after I'm done reviewing it.
I did notice in the most important news of the week, the trailer for the new Spider-Man movie came out.
I saw that.
And he's got a foldable phone. Spider-Man does.
It's a flip. Yep.
It's a flip phone. I couldn't tell quite what it was, what model, but the fact that Spider-Man carries a foldable phone, I feel like that is an interesting signal to point at the potential opportunities in this market. I'm sure, but I think we're all eyes are on Apple to see what it's going to do, but I agree. It's widely expected that Apple will release a foldable phone at some point.
Yeah, the 9to5 Google guys say it was a Z Flip from Samsung. That's not a surprise. They probably paid for that one. I would be shocked if they didn't. But there are still people who are not aware that these phones exist, so it's probably a good marketing opportunity for them.
I'm sure it's a good marketing opportunity for them. It's hard to beat having Spider-Man carry around your phone. That's a pretty good selling point.
Yeah, definitely.
So my second one, you've got the phones. I'll take the broadband. And my second news announcement that I think is worth pointing out this week is about Google Fiber and Astound Broadband. They announced a merger at the beginning of this week. Certainly very interesting. Both of them are the sort of tier two regional fiber providers in the US. But from a networking side, this is very much an example of the fiber land grab that's going on in the US right now. This is a big trend that I think is only expected to continue. We saw it with AT&T acquiring Lumen. We saw it with Verizon acquiring Frontier. And we've seen it with a lot of smaller acquisitions by some of the smaller fiber providers. Basically, it's a fiber land rush. The goal is to get as much territory as you can so that you can deploy fiber to it. And that's certainly what this acquisition between Astound and GFiber, that's what this stems from. And also it just means GFiber is stepping out of the market. What we don't have yet is an idea of whether this new merged company is going to be branded as Google Fiber or GFiber, or if they're going to keep the Astound broadband brand. It's the company Stone Peak is the majority shareholder for Astound, and obviously Alphabet is the majority shareholder for GFiber. Alphabet is going to keep a stake in the merged company. And the merged company is going to have about 7 million locations in 26 states when that merger is finished. And it is going to provide some fairly substantial competition against, and I believe Comcast and Charter. So those are who that merged company is going to be competing against after they merge. But yeah, it's another signal of the land grab that's going on. And I think in my mind, the question is, who's next? As companies increasingly acquire fiber providers, we've even seen T-Mobile, right, acquire several smaller fiber providers. And I think they're on their way toward 12 to 15 million total locations with fiber in the next few years. And so the question is, which company is going to be the next one that will be snapped up in this land grab? And from what I've seen, discussion is around Brightspeed or Uniti. Those are two other sort of regional DSL cable fiber providers. And so the discussion is possibly is Verizon emerging as a bidder for either Brightspeed or Uniti. Nothing announced, no real rumors along those lines, no published reports on discussions between those companies. But I think that's just generally market discussion. That is the next acquisition target, possibly Brightspeed or Uniti, with Verizon discussed as a possible acquisition candidate for that company. But again, nothing announced, but I think that's what's happening right now. It is a land rush, and really the question is, now we've got Astound and GFiber merging, who's next as these companies merge? And then the real question, though, that hangs over this whole market is, how many fiber providers are we going to have in big markets? Because many markets already have two fiber providers, and some markets already have three, and a few have four fiber providers in the same market. And that does seem like too many fiber providers. It really, the economics break down if you can only get 10 or 20% of a given territory in terms of fiber take rates. And once the number of fiber providers in a given market rises to a certain point, the economics just don't work out anymore. I think right now we're in that shakeout of the market in terms of number of providers in a given market, who owns all those providers, whether it's a wholesale business model or if they're going to direct to consumer. We're really seeing that shakeout right now. And obviously, you know, we're here on the 6G podcast. This all has direct importance to 6G because this is the grid that underlies all wireless networks. It's this fiber network is the grid that underlies current 5G networks. And certainly as companies build out fiber to new locations, that is the wired grid that will be the foundation for any 6G network for sure.
Yeah, I was going to say that I feel like this was semi-started by Google Fiber back when they first launched the service to create some kind of competition in internet services. And then Google Fiber stalled and stopped expanding. And then they bought, if you remember, Webpass for all the millimeter wave backhaul instead of having to dig. I don't think they really took advantage of Webpass's capabilities. I think they just bought the network and utilized it for what it was. The reason why I know that is because my aunt lived in a Webpass home in her condo, and they had Webpass, and I was really impressed with the speeds and stuff. But I wasn't impressed with the lack of growth, because I thought once Google bought Webpass, they were going to actually take advantage of that tech, and they never really did. I'm a little saddened to see Google Fiber get kind of hoovered into Astound. I will say that I'm not as familiar with Astound's network, so I did some research and looked into their deployments. They're fairly prominent in Texas, but they're also pretty prominent in the Northeast and a little bit in the Northwest. They also have some pretty big footprint in California. So they're in the more populated states, it seems. Nothing at all in Florida. Maybe they could be looking for some fiber down there. But yeah, I think you're right that
according to the New Street folks, Astound is actually primarily cable. Cable is 85% of their total locations. They have 4.5 million locations in 13 states. Astound does, and 85% of those are still cable. So they have a significant number of locations that they would presumably upgrade to fiber. Astound does, owned by Stone Peak Capital. But yeah, it's an interesting merger between those two. I don't think I would have expected that between GFiber and Astound.
And I will tell you, the general sentiment is negative in terms of Google getting acquired, or at least Google Fiber specifically, because I think a lot of people really had more trust in Google. But also they see this as Google giving up on another venture. And yeah, Google Fiber did provide some metros with real competition to cable and pushed cable to either lower prices or deploy fiber. So it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out long term. But I would also say, I feel like this current fiber land rush was started by AT&T and them kind of building out their fiber as they built out their 5G network and talking about how that influences their ability to build out that network and to serve enough, have enough capacity as backhaul. So I think it's really interesting that we're in this phase thanks to AT&T. I don't think, to your point, I don't think we're stopping anytime soon. And I will always chuckle at the fact that Verizon sold its fiber, most of its fiber business, and then reacquired it through an acquisition, them realizing maybe they needed that fiber. But yeah, I think this is not a total shock, but I would also say, to your point, there will probably be more consolidation. And I do think having multiple fiber options is good, but to your, very rarely do you actually have two companies coming in and bringing in different fiber. Like where I live, it's basically AT&T or Google piggybacking on AT&T's infrastructure.
And the GFiber network it's pretty remarkable. It's interesting that Google built that out. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense for Google to be an internet provider in just a handful of cities, essentially. That doesn't really gel. I understand why they wanted to do it in order to push competition and to raise speeds and lower overall internet prices. But I know that there were rumors that GFiber was for sale in the last few years. And I will say, just in terms of Ookla data on GFiber, their network is quite remarkable. And just in terms of speeds, they have very high speed tiers that they sell. We certainly see that in the data. One of the interesting things that we do see in the Ookla data is extremely low latency on that network, which I think is, my theory is that it's due to the rest of Google's infrastructure, right? That not only were they building a fiber network provider, they were also leveraging some of the routing and data center and long haul network that Google relies on for the transmission of just google.com and all the other Google services. So I think GFiber was always a standout, certainly one to watch, but was never going to be a nationwide play by Google. I just don't think that was their goal. And so I assume that from the Google perspective, it's mission accomplished, right? Like they created some additional competition for cable providers and other companies in the market with super fast speeds. And now they can bow out having accomplished what they set out to do, was what I assume that their viewpoint is on the market.
Yeah, I think so. I think I never actually used Google Fiber, mostly because AT&T was available to me at basically the same price. And AT&T is been really solid for me for the last 7 or 8 years. But I will say that there was a time when I used to get 1 millisecond ping on AT&T, and I think they realized they didn't need to deliver that, and they dialed me back to 5 milliseconds. So I do think that all fiber networks for the most part are capable of it. Whether or not they want to support it is a different thing.
Yeah, it does. I assume it requires significant investment in order to lower those latencies down past just a few milliseconds.
Yeah.
But we've got last topic and my last topic gel together. You want to go first?
Sure. So yeah. I saw this headline a couple days ago, and I didn't really think it was anything special because I've already discussed that Qualcomm plans on having 6G devices for the Olympics. But then I saw the mention that the Trump administration was specifically asking for 3 commercial 6G devices for the LA Olympics, and that the Trump administration plans to launch 6G in 2029, which is a year ahead of when everybody else is basically saying that 6G will be commercially ready, including leaders like T-Mobile. So it seems like there might be a little bit of a disconnect between with what the Trump administration wants and what the industry is working towards. Obviously, LA is happening in 2028, so it won't be anything commercial by any means.
The Olympics, the LA Olympics are happening in
28. It would have to be something pre-standard to a certain degree. It's unclear what standard that will be, but most likely it will be some form of 3GPP, and most likely it'll be release 20. But it was very interesting to see this headline because it seemed like there's a little bit of a reality distortion field around what the Trump administration wants and what the industry is working towards. And this was brought up during a Politico conference called Powering 6G. And it was an SVP of Global Government Affairs from Qualcomm. They're going to do what they can do, I think, at this point. But I will be very curious to see, one, what Qualcomm is able to deliver, and two, how the Trump administration will shape this, because they got into office in 2024, which means the election will happen in 2028. So I'm wondering how aligned this will be with their, it's not going to be a re-election campaign, we know that, but there's going to be some kind of effort to claim global 6G leadership, national pride, et cetera, at these Olympics. And I think that's a part of it. But Release 21 is technically going to be the real 6G standard. I'm very curious to see what this will actually be in terms of 6G because of the 2030 timeframe and how it's 2 years ahead of what everybody is actually planning for.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, so the NTIA, the government agency that is tied to the White House, which essentially is overseeing the BEAD program and many other programs, overseeing the Huawei Rip and Replace program. They, late last year, NTIA announced that they wanted 6G at the Olympics. So I assume that this all stems from a initiative within this current administration to push 6G at the Olympics. I think that there's a whole of government effort going on right now that is working on convincing companies like Qualcomm to move quickly so that the USA can proclaim a leadership position in 6G. It's the exact same thing that we had during 5G. It's the race to 5G. If you remember those, all those discussions, this is the same thing again. It is the race to 6G. It's each carrier and each government wanting to claim first. And certainly the LA Olympics are a good place for that to happen.
Do you remember the whole Verizon and KT back and forth within the same week?
It was within hours. And I think there was, my understanding was that, I think it was on the Verizon side, one of them had to rush it. They just had to rush it out. It was like several weeks ahead of time. And they saw what was going on in Korea and decided that they had to pull the trigger. Because you got to be first. You got to be first. You can't be a week late. No, that's not going to work. And I'm seeing the same thing on my side. I have seen some recent filings at the FCC regarding the WRC-27. And so this is actually related to what you're talking about, and it's about this whole topic. But what it looks like to me is that there's some early lobbying going on with regards to the ITU's World Radio Communications Conference next year, 2027. And for those not familiar with it, that is the international event where all country regulators, spectrum regulators, meet at the WRC meetings that are hosted by the ITU, and they're held all over the world. And the goal of those meetings is to get onto the same track in terms of spectrum, because the goal there is to avoid having 5G in this spectrum band in one country and 5G in a completely different spectrum band in another country. That doesn't encourage economies of scale. It just makes it really difficult to have a global communication system. And so the objective of the ITU and these WRC meetings is to basically get everyone on the same page. That's a very common, that's been going on for a long time. But the interesting thing here is that what we're starting to see from lobbyists like the CTIA and the NCTA is they're worried about this upcoming meeting next year in November of 2027, because it's going to be in Shanghai. And so they are saying, and I'll quote some of the things, is the CTIA is warning about rivals like China having an effect here. And then the NCTA wrote about the location of the conference in Shanghai could deter some stakeholders from undertaking this important work. And they're warning that, hey, it's because it's in China, we need to make sure that China doesn't have overt influence on the goings on at these meetings. And I think a lot of what this boils down to is the 6 and 7 gigahertz bands. So China has allocated the 6 gigahertz band for cellular licensed communications, including 6G. The US has not allocated the 6 gigahertz band to 6G. They are keeping the 6 gigahertz band for Wi-Fi. And instead, US regulators want to allocate the 7 gigahertz band for 6G. And so I think that all of this discussion going on right now is mainly related to that discussion, whether 6 gigahertz or 7 gigahertz should be ground zero for 6G. I expect that probably both bands will be used for 6G, but I know that there's going to be a lot of negotiation up until this WRC meeting in November of 2027 in Shanghai in order to get everything straightened out ahead of that meeting. And the last thing I'll mention is that as the 3GPP meets pretty regularly in order to develop standards for cellular communications, including 5G and 6G, the 3GPP just met in Japan. And from my, it's real hard to understand all the stuff that goes on in the 3GPP. It is a very technical organization. But from my little bit that I have been able to glean from their recent meeting in Japan is that the 3GPP did make some decisions on future cellular standards. They are looking at the 7 gigahertz band. And from what I understand, the latest thinking there is that they'll have up to, I think it's 200 megahertz wide channels or even possibly 400 megahertz wide channels, which is a crazy amount of spectrum, but that they're looking at technologies working in there. They're looking at full duplexing framework, all kinds of interesting technologies that they are thinking about for the 6G standard, multi-radio spectrum sharing. So that would allow simultaneous 5G and 6G transmissions in the 7 gigahertz band. And I think one of the most important things that the 3GPP is working on is they're working on a C-band grid compatibility for 7 gigahertz, meaning that a network deployment in 7 gigahertz would work on the same cell grid that has been built for the C-band or 3.45 gigahertz. And for network operators, that is an absolutely critical element for all this stuff, because what they really do not want to do is build a new cell tower grid for a new spectrum band. They want to use their existing cell tower grid to deploy new technologies. And they've already built out 5G networks on the C-band grid. And so if they can reuse that same cell tower grid for 6G, that undoubtedly that is their objective. It still means that they would probably, to put a 7 gigahertz network into operation, they would still have to invest in that spectrum and in new radios in order to broadcast in that band. But if they could reuse the same grid, that would lower the costs for the lower deployment costs for them. So that's a lot of interesting developments, right? We've got these sort of these big markers. We've got 3GPP is working on 6G standards. We've got international regulators meeting and trying to decide a way forward for most of the world at the WRC meetings. And so I don't know, I'm taking all these signals as that there's forward movement on 6G standards, 6G spectrum. Like, this is the kind of stuff that we watched in the early days of 5G. This exact same discussion for 5G, moving into new bands and new technologies for 5G. Same thing was happening again. So no surprises, but certainly a signal that things are moving forward in terms of spectrum, in terms of regulatory sort of unity. So yeah, it's not a surprise, but it's also good to see in terms of if you're betting on 6G, this is another signal that yes, it's going to happen.
I think the whole Chinese officials thing is very interesting. I do agree that it's most likely about the 6 gigahertz band. I was appalled by China's decision to allocate 6 gigahertz for 6G/5G only, because I'm a big Wi-Fi guy as well. And for me, 6 gigahertz was a Wi-Fi band, and it enables both Wi-Fi 6E and Wi-Fi 7, and it's going to enable Wi-Fi 8. So not having any of that 6 gigahertz spectrum is unfortunate, because it's much cleaner than the 5 gigahertz band is. And God knows we have so much interference in the 5 gigahertz, God forbid, 2.4 gigahertz bands. Also, I think we are going to see more allocation of spectrum for uplink because of AI. And I think there's going to be more demand for uplink traffic in general, especially if we have on-device AI and we have agents running on our phones. So I think that's going to be something that makes a lot of sense for 6G. And then the other thing was the whole site reuse thing. That is 100% something I saw Qualcomm talk about last year at MWC. Mm. It was one of their research projects, and it was explicitly around enabling 7 gigahertz at 3.5 in terms of coverage. So that sounds like a Qualcomm proposal, if you ask me. But it sounds like something that's necessary if we're going to see 6G deploy remotely close to what 5G can do in terms of footprint, because 6G is going to be standalone. So it's not going to be as quickly deployed as 5G was. And that might actually be a good thing for everybody, because even to this day, there's still a lot of 5G operators who don't have standalone. And that means that they just can't even deliver any of this 5G applications that were supposedly promised when 5G was marketed. So I think it's important that we have something like that enabled. And yeah, I think you're right. There's going to be a battleground on 6 gigahertz. And I think to your point, harmonizing around 7 gigahertz is going to be important, and making sure that band behaves remotely close to lower frequencies, because I can't imagine, from my experience, 6 gigahertz does not propagate very well. So I think 7 gigahertz is going to be even more of a challenge.
Very interested to see if, yeah, the propagation characteristics in 7 gigahertz is anywhere near C-band. But I think there was a lot of questions about the propagation characteristics of C-band in those early days. So I think it remains to be seen.
I personally think C-band still doesn't actually propagate as well as some lower frequencies. But I would also say that 7 gigahertz is going to be interesting, because I think to achieve that kind of propagation, I think you're going to end up having to have AI on both ends of the connection to make that beamforming and whatever else, what other techniques, super giga MIMO, whatever they end up calling it. That's probably going to have to be a new version of MIMO to make it possible. And yeah, I'm excited to see what actually becomes real, but I'm not sure we'll even know by 2028. It'll be fun to see how it shakes out. And yeah, I think we're in very interesting times right now.
Yeah, we'll see. Stay tuned.
Definitely. And I think that helps us wrap up longer podcast. We hope our viewers and listeners found this week's topics interesting. And please don't forget to reach out to us if you have any recommendations for a future podcast. And also, please rate us and subscribe. We're on all the platforms. You can find us on YouTube and any regular popular podcasting platform. All you need to do is find us at 6G Podcast, and we'll probably be at the top. Thanks again for listening. And Mike, thanks again for joining me.
Thanks a bunch. See you later.